This is the Popmatic Podcast for September 23rd, 2015.
We're heading for Mars.
The Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Bill,
Amanda,
Astronaut Mike,
Jeremy.
As you can hear from the echo, we're recording in the lobby of the Adventure Science Center.
Ooh.
We will be recording in impromptu locations around downtown Nashville, where the children's department at the main library is being remodeled. It's appropriate that we're recording at the Adventure Science Center because today's theme is somewhat science-based.
Somewhat.
Mars.
Mars.
Not the Roman god.
Maybe. We'll see what I talk about. Was that a spoiler? Now, not too long ago, we did a space episode.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we go back to Mars?
Because there's a movie.
Because the new movie, The Martian, is out.
We love Matt Damon.
I hate Matt Damon.
I knew I could get the way to say that.
Matt Damon. This week, Matt Damon has done two things that have made Matt Damon not a good person. First, he said that Jason Bourne could beat Batman in a fight.
Oh, that's tough. Yeah, cool. I take Batman.
Completely untrue.
Batman has like armor and weapons.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And then he white mansplained diversity to an African American woman on television. Apparently, I didn't see the clip, but I saw the headlines about it. So anyway,
I'm just mad that
Matt Damon.
Just mad that he ruined Interstellar.
Oh,
oh.
So
anyway,
that's a second chance now. He's going to go back to space to try to fix
astronaut
the Martian
movie.
I'm going to take Mike's word that the novel *The Martian* by Andy Weir was a great book.
Super fun.
Which rocketed its way, if you will. Rocketed its way out of the genre ghetto onto the bestseller list before it became a movie. And now that it's a movie, it's back on the bestseller list. So check that out. Popular book, popular movie, all about Mars. So we're talking about Mars in the Popmatic Podcast. Get pumped. Hey, Mike. You found Mars, the planet, right?
Indeed. I'm going to go full Jeremy and go like off on tangent again. Mars has always held a particular fascination for mankind. There are millennia-old records of Martian observation left behind by the Babylonians and ancient Egyptians. In much, much more recent times, in 1877, the discovery, quote-unquote, of canals led to the possibility of Martian life, a subject which enthralled science fiction for almost 100 years. Edgar Rice Burroughs built his career on tales of Barzub and John Carter of Mars and Tarzan, which doesn't count. H.G. Wells would destroy civilization with blood-drinking Martian invaders and the War of the Worlds. But in the 1960s, NASA sent probes that would definitively bust the myth of Martian canals, destroying the idea of, like, Martian civilization. But the legend that life on Mars once existed still persists and became something of a trope in science fiction. Today I thought I would discuss the most erudite and learned film that posits ancient Martian life in the most realistic way possible. Total Recall.
Yeah. Get
your bunch to Mars. Yeah.
Lost it during your setup.
You're going to give us the punchline so we can join you.
Fine, gang. You guys, no fun.
The most erudite.
Your mind. It is the center of your life. It is everything you hear, everything you see, everything you feel. It is everything you are. How would you know if someone stole your mind?
Arrest that woman!
Quaid.
Cut.
Get ready for a surprise.
We can't let him run around. He knows too much. They've got you bugged. I get a lock.
and the bug's in your skull.
Take this thing out of the case and stick it up your nose. Don't worry, it's self-guiding.
Got him.
I lost him.
Welcome to Mars.
You got a lot of nerve showing your face around here.
Look who's talking.
They erased her identity and implanted a new one.
If I'm not me, who the hell am I?
He's got a hologram!
Welcome to Johnny Cab.
Drive!
Where can I take you tonight? Please fasten your seatbelt.
I want Quaid delivered alive for re-implantation.
That's for making me come to Mars. You wouldn't hurt me. After all, we're married.
Consider that a divorce.
Hope you enjoyed the ride.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. There's
it is
Douglas
the showgirls
Quaid.
Of science fiction movies. That's, that's not true. It's the same director.
Same director, yeah.
That's why I said that.
I think that's the perfect...
It's pretty amazing. Plays Douglas Quaid, which, you know, he always plays these, like, white bread American name guys, like
My
John
name is
Smith.
Jim Smith.
You know, hello there. Ich liebe apple pie und mama. A construction worker on Earth who dreams of something more than his boring life. His friend convinces him to try Recall, a company that implants memories of a vacation instead of actually going on vacation, which saves money, presumably. He decides to become a spy on, or he selects to become a spy on Mars with a sneezy girlfriend instead of his wife, which is, like, just weirdly sexist now. The process goes awry, though, and commandos burst into the Recall offices and try to kill him. It turns out that he is a spy who had memories of being a boring construction worker and planned to go undercover. Then his construction worker friend tries to kill him. And then his boring but smoking hot wife, played by
Sharon Stone,
is really an assassin. And it's like, you know, how can you be that bored with young Sharon Stone? Come on. He eventually goes to Mars to join the Martian resistance with an assortment of motley mutants, climaxing with a terraforming machine hid within a giant Martian pyramid. It's awesome, you guys. One interesting wrinkle in the story occurs about midway through the film when a random person puts himself in the line of fire, claiming to be a Recall employee. He claims that everything that's happened to Quaid so far is a result of a malfunction in the Recall machine, and Quaid has to kill himself in the dream machine to return to real life. Of course, Quaid does not do this, but the possibility that this is all a tailor-made dream hangs over the rest of the film, especially the ending, which I thought, you know, pretty cool. Of course, you know, in the 2012 version with Colin Farrell.
You got to explain to the internet kids.
Yeah,
kids, you're not talking about
the original,
remake.
The fun one. The 2012 remake jettisons this plot point, in addition to not being set on Mars and sounding really boring.
It's not set on Mars?
No, it's set on England and Australia, and they take an elevator to Australia because that makes sense.
Who cares? Who wrote the script for that? Gary from Perth?
He wishes.
Yeah, you know.
He wanted that draft.
He wanted all that Total Recall money. You know, I skipped watching it. Feel free to mention in the comments that it's something to be endured, gang. I doubt it is. Another fun fact, the movie is based on Brian's homeboy Philip K. Dick's short story, We Could Remember It For You Wholesale, which does have a company that implants memories, but is in every other way completely different.
Completely
100% different. Total Recall is one of the better examples of late 80s, early 90s, cheesy / stupid / fun action movies, and maybe my favorite Arnold Schwarzenegger movie film other than the first Terminator. Scenes from it pop out throughout pop culture, you know, 2 weeks, you know, Quato, you know, Quaid, you know, the three-boot prostitute. He doesn't love this stuff.
That was a highlight of my youth.
You know, I heard that they, like, you know, the beginning, the crappy remake, that she makes a reappearance, but doesn't do much. But it turns out to be a fever dream or something equally lame.
What do you have, Jeremy? Can you get to the chopper? Amas Quagan, give these people air!
You know, we were already Finnish by this time.
Brian had it half edited by now.
No fun.
You know that
Arnold, you guys missed us, right?
Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to replace Donald Trump on The Celebrity Apprentice.
Yeah, I may actually watch it now.
Because he can't run for president.
What a loser.
Constitutional joke.
Yeah. So, brothers and sisters.
Yes.
Preach it.
I'd like to talk to you today about our friends, the ancient astronauts, and how they came to this planet thousands of years ago to bestow their blessings on our humble race. You don't believe me? What about Mexico's La Zona de Silencio? That's a shout out to Estamos Aquí. Or the Nazca Lines? Yes, solving the mysteries of the world with aliens is more than just an internet meme featuring a guy with a Babylon 5 haircut that you like. It is a real thing believed by real people like me. We cling to our space gods and our space guns because we live in fear that we're the only...
Sorry, I didn't see that coming.
Sorry. That we're the only intelligent beings in the universe. And I believe this like I believe... that everything's going to be okay, which is to say, not really. It's just that I desperately, desperately want the existence of aliens to be confirmed in my lifetime, even if that means putting my faith in stuff that's even wobblier than the stuff regular people put their faith in, and even if that means the total destruction of the human race. That is a sacrifice worth making, to know that there are beings out there who, like us, once looked up to the stars and said, Tuck-tuck!
My ears... My precious ears.
We need not imagine this blessed nightmare scenario, though, because there are plenty of alien invasion stories in the world to help us prepare for our inevitable destruction. Mars attacks, for example. You can approach Mars attacks from a number of different avenues. Most of you are probably familiar with Tim Burton's 1996 film, starring Jack Nicholson, Glenn Close, Annette Bening, Jack Nicholson, Natalie Portman, Pam Grier, Tom Jones. It has a giant, giant cast.
Professor, what do we know about them?
We know they're extremely advanced technologically, which suggests, very rightfully so, that they're peaceful. Now, I suspect they have more to fear from us than we from them.
Ladies and gentlemen, Martian Ambassador is going to say a few words.
Mind down, Mr. Ambassador.
That's a Martian? That's gross.
My God.
Yikes.
They blew up Congress.
Hey, we all make mistakes, Mr. President.
This could be a cultural misunderstanding.
Mr. President, they have a planet surrounded with thousands of warships.
What do you think, Marcia?
Kick the crud out of them.
Mr. President, we're gonna need you to safety.
Should we go this way?
Sorry, ma'am. There's a tour going through here.
Jack Nicholson.
This is the President of the United States.
I want the people to know that they still have 2 out of 3 branches of the government working for them, and that ain't bad.
Glenn Close as the First Lady.
I'm not gonna have that thing in my house.
Annette Bening.
People say they're ugly, but I think they've come to show us the way.
Pierce Brosnan.
Very curious.
Danny DeVito. Martin Short. Sarah Jessica Parker. Michael J. Fox. Ron Steiker.
Annihilate! Kill! Kill!
Jim Brown. Lucas Haas.
He made the international sign of the donut.
Jack Nicholson.
Whoa! Hey! You're Tom Jones, right?
And yes, Tom Jones.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone.
Mars attacks.
Why can't we all just get along?
It's based on a series of trading cards released by the Topps Company in 1962, which featured 55 cards of gruesome artwork from Pulp Fiction cover artist Norman Saunders and comic book great While they would, it caused such an outrage when it was released that the cards were pulled from shelves. The movie didn't cause that much of a stir, but it did put Sarah Jessica Parker's head on a chihuahua's body. So at least there's that. Mars Attacks, the film, isn't Tim Burton's greatest work. I'm going to say that's a three-way tie between Batman, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and Ed Wood. But considering it's based
on... Beetlejuice?
I'm not a Beetlejuice fan.
I don't want to bring you down. Don't bring me down! My trilogy would probably be Tim Burton's best work would probably be Pee Wee, Ed Wood, and Mars Attacks.
Okay,
I'm going with Batman, Ed Wood, and Beetlejuice.
Yeah, see, I just don't like Beetlejuice. I've never liked Beetlejuice. I never have.
Say it one more time and he shows up. I thought we were twins, but I guess not.
My wife also does not like this about me.
Because it's awesome.
I can maybe go back and watch it now and be like, you know what, I was wrong about Beetlejuice. That'll be my forthcoming memoir. But I don't. I watched.
I think your forthcoming memoir will be like a paragraph of the title, like, you know, titles are a long thing in civilization. Why? Oh. I remember back when titles were invented. Anyway.
Okay, I remember when titles were. I was a senior in high school and I was stuck in the bathroom.
That is how it would start.
Yeah. I put my title on my mantle.
You're gonna keep telling us more about something the library can check out.
So, yeah, it may not be his greatest film, or maybe it's on a list of his greatest films, but considering it's based on a series of cult trading cards and features Jack Nicholson as both the president and as a cowboy land developer, it is pretty darn good. But there are other ways to enjoy Mars Attacks in comics. Mars Attacks Firstborn is a series written by Chris Rial and features wonderful artwork by Sam Keith, who drew some other famous aliens in his career, namely capital A aliens in the miniseries Earth War, which we do not have at the library. He also created the Max, if you are familiar with 90s comics. This book has a gauzy nightmare quality, plus a downright cute little title character. Much more straight ahead, and maybe not as good, but still fun to look at, is Mars Attacks The Complete Collection, which collects 10 issues of IDW's Mars Attacks series. The best part about this book, though, is that it reprints all of the cards from the original top series, although they're kind of small, so you kind of have to look. There is a book which blows these books up to big old postcard size, but you'll have to get that from ILL, like I did. Meanwhile, let's all meet up at the Pizza Hut near the Great Pyramid of Giza to chant and hasten the arrival of our benevolent ancestors.
Oh, that's right, I got Dinosaurs Attacks through the library, never mind.
Oh, nice.
Nice meeting.
Bill, Amanda,
it's
my turn. You guys are both here. Who would like to go next?
Have a Mars off. Initially, when we were discussing topics for today and we decided on Mars, I begged everyone to make sure that we would not all talk about John Carter, Warlord of Mars, because I had a feeling that was coming, which then led to a discussion about John Carter, the ER doc, played by Noah Wiley, which then circled around to the fact that he now plays a guy on a show called Falling Skies, which is about an alien invasion, and that brought us back to space and back to Mars.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you wish you were in on our podcast planning session.
Behind the curtain, gang.
I have some sort of professional obligation to mention that he also plays the librarian.
He does, yes. Yes, the librarian.
I watched the first movie, that was enough for me.
See, you never know how deep that rabbit hole is going to go. So, but when I think about Mars, I think of the company that makes candy, like M&M's and Milky Way and Snickers and Left Twix. Left Twix.
You don't like the right Twix?
Sometimes they make right Twix, too. It was a joke.
Oh.
But seriously, folks.
Wow.
But also, I sincerely puzzled Mike on that. That was weird.
I like peanut butter Twix.
Left or right?
They eat both at the same time.
But so Mars like also makes pet food and combos, which I'm sure the author of my book for this week has eaten at some point. Probably the combos, not the pet foods. So this week I'm going to talk about the delightfully sweet treat Candy Girl by Diablo Cody. And you might recognize her name because she's kind of become Hollywood's it girl for edgy, captivating scripts. Like, for example, her debut Juno in 2010. She also wrote the Showtime series, United States of Terra. And then recently she wrote the script for Ricky and the Flash, which stars Meryl Streep and her daughter, Minnie Merrill. I don't know her name. Sorry.
Minnie Gilmer.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. I knew Bill would know.
Minnie Merrill.
Daughter,
it's
whatever.
Just Vern Troyer with a wig.
That's right. In a wedding dress, whatever.
I'm over the room next.
So if you already haven't guessed it, Candy Girl is not actually about candy. It was released in 2005, and it was Cody's first project, and it chronicled her year as a stripper. So on a whim, Cody decided to sign up for amateur night at a strip club called the Skyway Lounge in Minneapolis, and she enjoyed the experience so much that eventually she quit her day job and became a full-time stripper, you know, like you do. And I feel like we may have mentioned this in a past podcast, but I asked Brian and he said we didn't, so it's a free-for-all. And it's either way, it's been a long time, so we can talk about everything else she's done since Candy Girl.
You're trusting my shattered mind.
Well, I figured it involved a computer at some point, so a 50-50 shot. So it's kind of a stereotype that pretty girls can use stripping to pay their way through medical school. And I have to admit that I'm a little bitter about that because I've never really been skinny enough to seriously consider this for an option. I just had to go into debt like everybody else with school loans. And maybe not as much as I've actually gone to medical school because I didn't. But, you know, a girl can use a little extra money here and there. And then I read this book. And now I'm very thankful that I never had to be a stripper because, and actually I think they prefer the term exotic dancer now because it's classier.
What did they say to me?
But the the stripping
as I make it rain. It's exotic dancer, sir.
Dance, baby, dance.
I've never been to a strip club in my entire life.
So sincere.
I just want to say that.
So the stripping itself, I don't think is that horrendous. It's all like then they have to go down and socialize with all the drunk, grubby men that want lap dances and like other VIP excursions to the finger quotes back rooms that I'm going to pass on. And then Cody also expanded her horizons after stripping, and she worked in an adult bookstore / peep show business, which was really creepy. And I like Diablo Cody as a writer. She's kind of got a great voice, but I think I'm going to leave the stripping to the professionals and keep my day job. But maybe I should have gone to medical school because then I would have met sexy doctors like John Carter and gotten to visit Mars for free.
Oh, we're going to bring it back. You bring it back so well.
I make the circle.
Wow, that's good.
All right, Mr. Bill.
Not be unbroken.
Oh, there's also a neat scene in Ricky and the Flash where the band is playing the group that Meryl Streep's in, and there's this lone dancer dancing to it. That's Diablo.
She gets a cameo.
It's just a neat little. She's really an interesting dance. She's doing so. Well, I want
she
to
said
talk.
Practice.
Close on.
Yes, close on. Okay. Well, I want to talk about, and bear with me, Raymond Chandler's 1939 hard-boiled crime novel, The Big Sleep. Now, Gumshoe or Private Eye Philip Marlowe arrives at the house of General Sternwood, an elderly and very wealthy man. General Sternwood is being blackmailed again by Arthur Geiger, and it seems General Sternwood's promiscuous daughter is at it again. Interesting things start to happen. Why does General Sternwood's other daughter, Vivian, is so interested, and why does she think he's looking for her husband, Rusty Regan, who's missing? And how does Joe Brody fit in? And why does casino owner Eddie Mars care?
Oh, oh.
Got there.
I like the giant font that I could read from here.
Well, are the rumors true that Eddie Mars' wife Mona Mars ran off with Rusty Regan? Why is everyone so interested if Philip Marlowe is looking for Rusty Regan? Which, by the way, he's not. The Big Sleep is one of the great Private Eye novels of all time. It's filled with murder, blackmail, double crosses, you know, good American stuff. Read The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler. Oh, and my three favorite Tim Burton movies are Ed Wood, Big Eyes, and Sleepy Hollow. The more conventional ones.
Yeah, okay.
Brian.
Ed Wood is a
common point, yeah.
I've never seen it.
It's excellent.
That's his best movie.
That's his best
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
But it's also a lot not like his movie. Edwin?
I
just said I haven't seen it, and he said I should watch it.
I'm sorry, listeners. I was trying to make an off-mic comment to Amanda.
I thought you were trying to be like Jeremy is wrong about everything he says.
Well, he said that after.
Batman first part doesn't exist in my world.
For fear of being physically attacked, yeah, the Batman movie sucks. But
whoa!
Anyway.
Wow!
Yeah. So
okay,
I'm
so
Batman.
And cool. When I was a child, I watched Beetlejuice until the tape wore out, and the only thing that I really care about Beetlejuice now is I'm in love with Winona Ryder forever, right? But that I don't care about the Beetlejuice movie. So.
That makes you want to not watch Beetlejuice.
I do not like Beetlejuice.
I remember when
I walked out of the theater, there was these two teenage girls goes, I want to see that again. I wanted to choke them.
Oh, teenage girls. Please write Popmatic at popmatic.com.
I watched, so I, the town where I live did not have a movie theater. The movie theater closed. The last thing that I saw there was the He-Man and She-Ra movie.
Well, I can see why you think Beetlejuice is a good movie then. No theater in your hotel. No, the last movie you saw was the He-Man movie.
No, I didn't think Beetlejuice was
a good movie. No, he doesn't like it. I'm the only one on here.
I got to see like the occasional movie. But didn't see movies until it came on VCR, but we had to rent a VCR from the video store because we didn't own one for a long time. So basically like the only thing that I watched for the most part was like Goonies and Star Wars. But I watched Saturday morning cartoons, and I really liked the Beetlejuice cartoon that was on, which now
I can't remember that.
It's awful.
I'm sure it's awful. Yeah. But like Beetlejuice and Lydia, which is my sister's name, strangely enough, they were friends on that show, and I thought, oh, they're pals. And then I watched the movie.
Yeah, I guess if you watched the cartoon before the movie, it'd be really confusing.
It's not even remotely. But like, they go to the ghost world. They spend a lot of time there.
This is what happens when you guys are here.
Yeah, like, I'm just
right down the rabbit hole.
You missed us, right?
This is a pop culture podcast.
That's right.
So I watched that cartoon, and then I watched. Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
He calls you out for talking, and so you just go right back to talking.
That's what I did in elementary school.
So forgive me. Right,
anyway.
I am going to derail our pop culture podcast and talk about a pretentiously serious literary
book. Oh, that's right. You're still going. I'm so sorry. I wouldn't have kept talking if I forgot you were going.
So let me talk about a pretentiously serious literary work.
That's why I lean back.
As a host, I don't participate. Oh, wait. This week I'm going to talk about
this. So, when I was thinking about Mars, I just could not thinking about the god Mars and then the zodiac and the calendar and the changing of the year. And I think maybe it was just because I just read The Wicked and the Divine. And like in between the individual issues of that, they have this page that's like a stylized zodiac calendar. And the one is this really awesome ram, you know, for Aries, the sign that is ruled by Mars. And I don't know why, I just kept thinking about the zodiac and the calendar when I was thinking about Mars. And the book that I kept thinking of is The Children of Days, A Calendar of Human History by Eduardo Galeano. And this book takes its inspiration from medieval Book of Days, but The Children of Days, each page is like a date throughout the year. And then there's like a little like basically history lesson or like an episode of history that happened on that each day. Now, Galeano is from Uruguay, and most of them have to do with Latin American history, but they're usually forgotten episodes in history that people don't remember. Some of them are really uplifting, really happy, good stuff, and then some of them are like really horrible, evil things that men do to one another. It's kind of like maybe if like William Volman made one of those daily calendars where you pull the page out every day.
It's made of skin.
Yeah.
So since this is a pop culture podcast, here's the one for whichever date that I did bring the book. I don't remember the exact date, about Johnny Weissmuller and him playing Tarzan, which I don't remember.
That would be the entry for March 28th, Manufacturing Africa.
When it opened in 1932, Tarzan of the Apes drew long lines at the movie houses. Tarzan's howl from Hollywood has been the language of Africa everywhere ever since, even though the actor, Johnny Weissmuller, was born in Romania and never set foot in Africa. Tarzan's vocabulary had its limits. He only knew how to say, "Me Tarzan, you Jane." But he swam like no one else, winning 5 gold medals at the Olympics, and he yelled like no one had ever yelled. That King of the Jungle howl was the work of Douglas Shearer, a sound man who mixed voices for gorillas, hyenas, camels, violins, sopranos, and tenors. Female fans besieged Johnny to the end of his days, begging him to howl.
Oh, Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Those are pretty good, yeah. Those movies are kind of fun, actually. And they were pre-code, so there was actual nudity in the first one, which young Mike enjoyed quite a lot on AMC.
So I picked that one because it does have to do with pop culture, even though it is about how like dumb Americans view Africa and about how, you know, this illusions that we create in media. But most of them are actually about really horrible, dark stuff. Like, for instance, the first bishop in Brazil was eaten by cannibals, But now historians don't know if that's true or not, if they think that maybe the church just might have made that story to have negative propaganda against indigenous peoples in Brazil. No one knows. So things like that are kind of what are in the book.
That's fun.
For a lot of years, Galeano was actually exiled from Uruguay while there was a military dictatorship. Banned books pregame! And his books were banned in Uruguay and Chile and Argentina for a number of years. But in 1985, he got to move back to Uruguay. And he writes novels and history books. Banned books pregame! Hey, wait, what's the...
Hey, guys.
Hey, guys.
What do we do?
Want to tickle my fancy?
Well...
We creep our listeners out.
Maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't.
But either way, it's tickling our fancy. Bill?
Okay. If you're a baseball fan, this time of year is special because you have pennant races, playoffs, and the World Series.
Okay.
If you're a Chicago Cubs fan, this time of year can be quite torturous.
It really is.
It's true. Cubs fans can tell you where they were on October 14th, 2003. It was Game 6 of the National League playoffs, Chicago Cubs versus the Florida Marlins. The Cubs were leading the Florida Marlins 3-0. And four outs away from going to the World Series. Then on aisle 4, row 8, seat 113, a foul ball was hit. Moses Alou runs to catch it, and Cub fan Steve Bartman reaches out to catch the ball and deflects it from outfielder Moses Alou, who then throws a fit and claims he could have caught the ball.
What a dork.
The Cub loses the game in the series, and Steve Bartman becomes a scapegoat, which is the topic of an excellent documentary called Catching Hell, which deals with Bartman incident and the Buckner ball going through his legs. The DVD is called Catching Hell, and if you don't like baseball, watch it anyway, because it deals with fans, scapegoats. I mean, it's quite an excellent documentary because it deals with all aspects of that topic and that one incident and what happened after that incident. So it's directed by Alex Gibney. I highly recommend Catching Hell.
It's super good.
I was sitting on my couch in my apartment watching the game, and then after that happened, I turned the TV off because I knew they were done.
Well, that's the whole thing. They said after that incident, just everybody was up and positive, and it was just like,
yep, they were
just
done.
Sucked out the energy of that game. It was
no
amazing.
One snatches defeat from the jaws of victory like my coach.
This year, I don't know about this year. Everybody says this year. My friend says 2019.
That's that would be 111 years since they've been in the World Series.
I mean, they're in the wild card.
I just want to punch all the Boston fans that were whining. I'm like, seriously, you have no idea.
That's true.
I'm like, come on. Okay, anyway. So, as a food writer, let's change topic. As a food writer, I love Michael Rollman. He's probably my second favorite food writer after Ruth Reichel, who is coming here in a little over a week. Happy birthday to me. And I totally stumbled across Rollman by accident one day. I was browsing through our Hoopla collection. We've got his books on audio. Readers of our off-the-shelf blog will recognize his name because I've written about him a couple times, first for his first two books, The Making of a Chef and The Soul of a Chef, in addition to his cookbook that he wrote about eggs. And I've had his book, The Reach of a Chef, on my desk for a little while and finally had a chance to sit down and actually read it. And I really enjoyed it. Rollman's subject matter is the definition of a chef. Is a chef someone who cooks? Are chefs artists? What about branding a chef or celebrity chefs like Bobby Flay or Emeril Lagasse? Just what does it take to make somebody a chef? And in this book, Rollman goes back and visits the chef friends that he first met when he was writing the first books I mentioned, to kind of see how far they've come in the handful of years since he first wrote about them. He talks to Michael Simon about moving his popular Lola restaurant to downtown Cleveland. It was kind of on the outskirts. He follows, I can't say this gentleman, these names, but, he follows Grant Ashatz, I think is his name, as he opens Alanea in Chicago, as well as Thomas Keller when he expanded his empire. Thomas Keller is a chef at the French Laundry. And then he opened Per Se in Manhattan. And then for comparison, he also talks about Emeril and Rachel Ray and how they kind of made their fortunes in television instead of in the kitchen. And he goes so far as to set up Rachel Ray to maybe topple Martha Stewart's empire. We haven't really seen that happen, but it could. So far, this is probably my favorite book of his. My only complaint is that it was written in 2006, so some of the data might be a little bit old. And now I want him to go back and write a 10 years later update. So do you hear that, Michael Ruhlman? In your free time, you need to go back and do another Where Are They Now expose. As far as I can find out, most of the chefs in the book are still cooking, still running the restaurants. But I really want more details and free samples. Maybe not of the $400 sushi from Masa's in Manhattan, but I'm happy to try most of the other stuff, especially anything pastry.
Pastry. I'm going to play a fire and briefly recommend two things this week. First thing, sugary cereal enthusiasts and Shocktober aficionados may be interested to know that Frankenberry is now in stores. Oh. Stock up, gang.
So why are you here? Why are you not in the store?
I was, at a Walgreens last week looking for a charger for my phone. I was like,
and, have you done the Monster Mash where you do all of them in one bowl?
No, but I want. Whoa, okay.
We can fun.
New project. Tickle my fancy. Tickle my fancy next month game.
One night. I was playing video games alone. That's right.
That was for you.
I'm sorry. That was really mean.
Wow. Yeah, wow. Thanks, buddy. I tease you all the time. I guess it's only fair.
I fold laundry alone all the time.
Mm-hmm. I can recommend that thing.
Oh, that's right.
I go to clubs. Do drugs and dance with very attractive young people from foreign countries.
Well, you do have a heroin chic deal going.
I was on my bicycle 15 minutes before I came here.
Sure. Longer thing. Anyway, recently one of the movie groups I follow on Facebook posted a comic strip from an online comic called Hark a Vagrant, which caused me to laugh uproariously in the middle of the Noodles and Company in Green Hills. I thought I would check out the book at the Noodles and Company.
Okay, I've laughed at the Noodles and Company.
Well, normally you laugh at their prices and their terrible food.
Well, if you charge me $15 for mac and cheese.
Yeah. Oh, man. That was the last time I ate there, but not recommending that. I thought I would check out the book that we have in the collection, also called Hark a Vagrant by Kate Beaton, and I enjoyed it immensely. Beaton basically takes history and literature and makes a really funny comic strip out of them, usually with a lot of modern vulgarity that I cannot mention on this podcast. But the strip that made me laugh really hard, beep, is about Macbeth, the the witches in Macbeth. Wow. vulgarity. The witches in Macbeth curse all the kings in Scotland to become handsomer and handsomer, leading King James to turn to Shakespeare and say, "Did that really happen?" with big wide eyes. And Shakespeare replies, "Yes." Which made me laugh. You need to see it. She's been doing a series lately with the Founding Fathers. She's Canadian, but she shows the American Founding Fathers, which is, kind of neat to me. She, whips up, comic strips on, Canadian history, where you're just like, oh, cool,
don't
Canada,
get it.
I
don't get it.
Yeah, it's like, oh, cool, what's his face? There's a new collection of strips coming out soon. I think the week before this post. It's called Stand Aside Pops. I have a hold on it. It sounds pretty funny.
She has a kid's book, too,
about a pony.
Yeah, Princess and the Pony, I think his name is.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny.
My son enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. There's a nice fart joke in it.
So that makes the new book better.
Yeah. Particularly my fancy this week is a collection of noir short stories by Gil Brewer. It's called Redheads Die Quickly and Other Stories. Brewer wrote some novels and short stories mostly in the 50s and 1960s. He wrote... he's the author of such books as Satan is a Woman, and his most famous book is 13 French Street, which I think was turned into a movie, but I can't remember what the name of the movie is.
Future Correction! No!
The future is now. 13 French Street was made into a film by French director Jean-Pierre Mocky.
These stories were published mostly in the 1950s in magazines like Manhunt, and there's plenty of cheating spouses, raw deals, and exploding yachts. They're very mean and ugly stories, and sometimes they end sort of darkly, where it's like Jim sit down with the gun and shot himself in the head. And
sounds like something I would do.
It's almost laughably dark in a way, because it's more like, I think today we're maybe more used to slightly more ambiguity in a story. But, like, if you're reading it in a book, you know, but if you imagine, like, reading it in, like, a magazine at the grocery store, I think it would be pretty darn shocking to someone in 1955. There's a lot of, like sex and, like, men angry at women in these stories, and his editors said that that was sort of holding him back from becoming a greater writer.
Yeah, I follow you on Goodreads now. I saw your book, and I was like, ooh, that sounds interesting. And I remember the reviews, almost all of them were like, these are shockingly misogynist.
Yeah. Yeah. Even like, for the 50s.
Yes, he must have had some real issues.
Yeah.
Like, you know, was he abandoned by his mom or something?
Probably.
Thinking that, like, you know, maybe that helps.
There's a little bit of lady hate in there. But don't let that turn you off, folks.
I really liked it.
That's still good, gang.
Ding.
If you sort of hate women but don't feel good about it, read this book.
You mildly dislike women.
You can live vicariously. Have issues with your mother? I've got a book for you. Brian?
I love my mother very much.
Good for you.
My mother is an awesome person.
That must be nice.
She's also a witch, which was a teaser to the book I'll talk about next week. What is tickling my fancy this week is that my favorite band became the first band ever to play in the People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea.
Wow.
And the fact that one of favorite bands was the first band from the West to play in North Korea pretty much tells you everything that you need to know about me.
In North
this
Korea.
This totally makes sense.
How did that happen?
They made an entire electric song about how Kim Jong-un is the greatest dictator ever.
Can we acknowledge that you're talking about Skinny Puppy?
I didn't name the band yet.
Yeah.
So it's the Slovenian art rock band or industrial band Liblock became the first.
I thought you were talking about Skinny Puppy.
First band from Europe to ever play in North Korea. Now what's funny is actually the only reason though this does tickle my fancy, this actually happened last month, like about a month ago, and it was actually there was a feature on the John Oliver show about it, because he was kind of shocked. And then he did, like, a piece lampooning Liebach. He's like, be invited to play in North Korea? But throughout Liebach's career, they actually, are you ready, have this weird kind of fascination with Mars. They keep making references to it. So there's this song sponsored by Mars on their record Capital, which is maybe the best album ever recorded. And then the sample at the very beginning of the show, about where the guy with the voice says, "We're going to Mars," is actually from the final countdown. That was from their album NATO, but it's a cover of the Europe song Final Countdown. But because NATO is actually all about Europe in war, because it was actually recorded during the chaos and war in Yugoslavia. Liebach is from Slovenia, by the way, so they lived through all that, literally. It's actually, they changed the lyrics because in the Europe version of the song, they say we're going to Venus. But this was all about, like, war in Europe, the album NATO. So they changed the lyrics to we're going to Mars. And then also on the NATO album, they also have the song called Mars on the River Drina, which is a really famous, I think it's a Yugoslavian march, but it's the actual name of it is March on the River Drina.
March on the River Drina was actually a Serbian song. It was popular in communist Yugoslavia, but is often associated with Serbian nationalism.
But they changed the name to Mars on the River Drina because it's about war in Yugoslavia. Do you get it? And Mars is the god of war.
That's fun. Okay.
Wow.
That's fun.
Now, what's funny is Liebach are described as like this art troupe, and like many of the bands I like Wolf Eyes and Throbbing Gristle that I talk about in the podcast, they're actually like, they don't just make music, they make films, they make sculptures, they make visual art, they do art pranks. They just had a retrospective of the Tate Modern a few years ago. And ironically, they also had to crowdfund their last American tour, though they get paid to go to North Korea.
By North Korea?
But one of the things that they do is...
two chickens.
Because they grew up in...
I'm surprised they had the chickens, you know, they're eating grass over there.
I know, right?
Yeah,
that's all fancy.
There's pics if you want to see... They grew up in Yugoslavia, which prided itself on not being part of the West or part of the East in the sense during the Cold War anyway, in the sense that we were like in between. Like, I don't know how other people perceived Yugoslavia, but that's how Yugoslavia perceived themselves.
Tito and the Yugo.
Under Tito. So what they kind of did was use like extreme fascist imagery and extreme communist imagery to kind of show how these like intense dictatorial ideologies are the same, and as you guys, what's like one of my favorite books?
Europe Central?
Yeah, William Vollman, which is all,
which is
all about how those ideologies play together and create psychological weirdness, and that is basically what Liebach has done their entire career. They always get confused of being fascist, they always get confused of being communist, and no one ever knows how to interpret their work. And the one of the things I thought was, what if like Kim Jong-un kind of realizes, oh shit, this joke's on us, and Liebach doesn't come back? Because, you know, if you think that they're serious about some of their stuff, I don't know, right? I feel like maybe...
Interesting.
Maybe...
They got confused. Oh, you know, it's kind of like the Chinese don't understand that The Onion is a satire and will post, like, you know, stuff in their newspapers going like, wow, Area Man really does.
I don't know. But...
So they were invited. They have to be invited by the government, I'm assuming, or
yes,
so they'd have to be.
Yeah, they too.
In North Korea without the government.
They were invited by the government, but I'm trying to think. I don't know if they were approved by like the marshal
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, I don't know if he actually like approved them or not. But
Dennis Rodman was like, "Hey, you got to hear this band."
It's a final countdown.
Most of Liebach's discography is on Hoopla.
I have some corrections.
I'm shocked.
Wow. Go for it, Jeremy.
Ooh.
Spawn is not a good movie.
That is true.
I don't think anyone said it was.
Someone said that I was going to defend Spawn.
Okay.
Oh, burn.
And I was not going. I was going to see Spawn on its opening night, 1997, when I was a senior in high school. But I was stuck at home in the bathroom because I had a stomach ache. But I made out. I think I got the better end of the deal. Also,
I went to the Dollar Theater to see it, and I wanted my dollar back.
That wasn't an opinion, that was a bloviation.
Oh, okay. Also, I did not say that whatever that...
Sorry, that wasn't a correction.
Some doctor, whatever, you said that I told you that some doctor's name that Bill pronounced, that I said it was easy to pronounce. I did not say that. I think you were just trying to stir up the stuff kept me from seeing Spawn on opening night.
That was just totally me manipulating things as a producer. Yeah. And it worked, too, because Bill flipped you off. Yeah. And that was funny.
Oh, so it was made for you.
I told you we'd save it for this. What are you guys talking
about? Awesome. I did not say that. So that's all I got.
I was just surprised that tiny boots are called booties. I guess I will come out with a type of fashion called underoos and laugh when people get confused. Those are for adults. Yeah, you fool. What a dummy.
At least I'm not walking around with baby booties on.
Well, the other skill.
What a weird, you know. Sure, I'm going to go wear a bib. Oh, you're wearing a bib? Oh, yeah, but actually, it's B-I-B.
It's fine.
Booties and, you know, bootacular.
What's that thing where adult men dress up as babies and are
scary
into it? Yeah.
Like strange fetish we can't mention.
That's called infantilism.
Okay.
You can Google that when your kids are asleep. But I skillfully deflected that I thought you meant baby booties too. And then I just acted like,
well, I was really just puzzled about the whole thing, and then I figured it out when I listened back later.
Yeah.
So I felt like sharing.
Did you notice that I just was in denial that I thought it was baby booties
too?
Everybody
was just talking about socks, and I was like, what?
Everything's coming clean on this. This is the...
That's right.
I feel like I'm educating you in fashion, so...
I've lived with a woman for 13 years, and I still don't understand...
Booties.
Anything.
Where babies come from.
Yeah. Every month, I'm like, again?
Yeah, I was like, wow, so I'm supposed to call it a blouse and not a shirt? What?
So my confessions... I said flounder through a podcast. Flounder is a fish, not a verb.
That's a verb,
isn't it? Is it a verb?
You're floundering. Yeah, you're floundering.
Yeah. You're floundering right now.
So I wanted to confirm this, and the word flounder, is it derived from the fish? Because the fish kind of does
flops
that.
Flops around. I think that's so, the best thing, yeah.
If you guys say so.
Yeah. Sure.
That's all I got. Our theme music is by... Everything is wrong this episode. It's like...
it's backwards day.
It's falling apart. For more information about flounder and verbs and fashion, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
Our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week, I'll say Banned Books Week the same way we say Adam Dean. Next week...
Woo! With Adam Dean.
That's kind of like...
Bring your own fire.
Banned Books Week is kind of like spring break for me.
Ask you about another one of your films, because again, like you say, you've been doing this for 30 years. You've been in so many amazing films. You started very young.
I'm 33.
There you go, 33. That's your
43.
First.
43. I'm 43. I'm turning 44 in October.
Oh my God, that's crazy! Congratulations.
I'm Baby Jane now.
There you go.
Yeah.
I want to, because there's been talk about maybe being a sequel to Beetlejuice. Can you confirm or deny this?
I think I can confirm it because Tim Burton did this it was very hush-hush, top secret. I don't know what may happen, I don't know. And then he did what he was doing, some press for Big Eyes, and he did an on-camera interview, and he said, oh, yeah, we're doing it, and Winona's going to be in it.
That's very exciting.
And I was like...
Very exciting news.
So can I say that, I mean, if he said it, I can...
If he said it, then you can't, that's just, it's on the record
now.
Yeah,
but I really don't know much more than anybody.
Do kids still approach you about that movie? Does it endure? Does, like, a younger generation know it?
Yes. Little kids. And I think, I love that. I'm so touched by that because how do they know? We're living in, there's so much CGI and Middle Earth and there's all this stuff and like... That they love Beetlejuice and they like, that must mean there's something very sort of pure about it.